Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. The days of the Old West could be a brutal place. Cattle barons, lawless towns, and outlaws seemed to be dotted all over the country. And Lincoln County, New Mexico, was no different. From Billy the Kid's ghost to La Llorona, a ghostly steer terrorizing the locals, to a twice-hung man, John LeMay joins me on a trip to haunted Lincoln County. But before we join John, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. And you can also click the link in the show notes as well. Thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support me and the show with your contributions. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And you can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes and updates. Our exclusive merchandise site is available via TeePublic, and you can find the link for that in the show notes. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. And the show is produced by Mr. Brandstore of the Ghost Story Guys. Billy the Kid is far more than a legend of the Old West, as we will discover in the company of John LeMay. Lincoln County in New Mexico is instantly recognisable to anyone who knows the story of one William H. Bunny and the infamous Lincoln County War. Yet Billy the Kid's restless spirit is not alone in haunting Lincoln County, and in his latest book, John LeMay introduces us to many a haunted location and legend. John, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Paul. I appreciate it.
Well, it's always nice to spend time in your company. And obviously this is a bit of a departure for both of us, really, because this is more of a historical guide and looking into the legends associated, as I said in the introduction, some of the most notable outlaws in the Old West. Whereas before, it's obviously been a collection of newspapers. This is more about you putting your boots on the ground and doing some ghost hunting on our behalf, John.
Yeah, I actually can put boots on the ground in this case, because Lincoln is less than an hour away from Roswell, and it's just sort of a really nice foresty recreational area that Roswell people love to go and visit. So it wasn't, you know, any type of ordeal. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And I would imagine it's become quite a popular destination, not just for a recreational break. I would imagine you've got people from all around the world who visit Lincoln County.
Absolutely.
Primarily,
yeah,
because of Billy's history with it.
You get a really nice twofer, you know, two for one when you come to southeastern New Mexico, because you go to Roswell and you see the aliens and the UFO museum. And yeah, again, it's just a 1 hour drive to the west, actually less than 1 hour, to go see the State Monument of Lincoln. It's just an entire town preserved exactly as it was in the Old West. And you can see the courthouse where Billy the Kid escaped and all that stuff.
I know you mentioned in the book, obviously, it was one of those places where, as you can probably sort of suggest, Tombstone was there. It's infamous because of how violent it was, John.
Yes.
But I think sometimes with these places, it's more to do with the quality of the outlaw that lives in that particular neighborhood. Because I would imagine Lincoln wasn't any worse than any other kind of place at that era, really. But obviously the fact that Billy the Kid's tied to this place and Pat Garrett has kind of elevated it above perhaps some other locations where more people were murdered or things were as out of hand as they got here. But obviously, because nobody really famous is connected to it, this place is far outweighs anywhere else.
Absolutely. I always compare Billy the Kid to James Dean, because even though he didn't take a very good picture, most people regarded him as a ladies' man and as very good-looking and charming. And because he died when he was young and good-looking and so well-loved, people really glorified him. And I think that's the main reason why Lincoln, you know, is also kind of glorified along with him.
Mm. Do you think, I mean, Billy's one of those characters, I think, that there seems to have been a real resurgence in people not sort of accepting the original story as to who's the good guys, who's the bad guys here, John. And I think when you look at that particular period of history, I suppose it's very difficult because most people were quite dodgy, shall we say.
Yeah.
There's no black and white in this. I think everybody involved in the Lincoln County War was probably grey, because it seemed that there was a lot of people who just wanted to make as much money as possible, and they were basically just butting heads against each other, and then it would always spill over into violence.
Absolutely, yeah. Because in terms of the Lincoln County War, most people regard the good guys as Billy the Kid, John Tunstall, who was an English rancher, and Alexander McSween and John Chisholm. Then the bad guys were Lawrence G. Murphy and James Dolan. But really, you know, Tunstall and Chisholm, they just wanted to make money the same as Murphy and Dolan. So they really weren't any different. It's just because Billy the Kid was on their side, and Billy the Kid tends to get made into a hero. You know, it's like you said, it's really all gray, not black and white.
Do you think he's probably the outlaw that's been most romanticized about? Because obviously you could probably say Doc Holliday is another one where I think people tend to think Doc Holliday was like Val Kilmer's performance in Tombstone, whereas history suggests he was, you know, he wasn't a man to mess around with.
Yeah. Well, again, I'll base it just on the shallow fact that people thought Billy was good looking, you know, because Jesse James, maybe when he was younger, he was good looking, but he died older and maybe not, he didn't die in his glory days like Billy the Kid. And again, I just think that's why people just gravitate towards him more than the others, perhaps.
Mm. Especially as James is regarded as a bit of a Robin Hood figure as well, wasn't he?
Because yes, yeah.
I mean, they say that, but I think he was just bribing people. I don't think he was giving his money away out of the goodness of his heart, John. I think he was like paying for board and lodgings more than anything. But he was quite generous with what he paid, I think. It's the reason the James gang were probably a bit more thought and obviously taking it to the man and the banks and things. Whereas I suppose it's one of those aspects of it that people seem to view banks as victimless crimes, but you know, the James gangs would shoot up the banks and kill the tellers. Yeah. And that's, you know, it wasn't the guy's bank who they killed. He was just working there. So,
yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, how long, when you look at Billy's history, John, do the stories, I mean, there are several aspects to Billy the Kid's life and what happened afterwards, but how long afterwards do the stories of Billy's spirit start? Is it something that happens almost immediately? Because obviously, because it's such a messy period in history, it almost seems like straight away the conspiracy theories started saying that Billy wasn't dead, it was a cover-up, he's got away, and there are questions about the body in the casket and the fact that Billy's family said it wasn't his son, and earlobes and all this. Not that I'm trying to suggest that I know a lot, but it's as with anything, John, I watched something fairly recently before we decided to have a chat about your new book. So it's quite apt that obviously Billy the Kid's included in it, because I was watching something about his earlobes being the clue as to not being why people thought he wasn't the person they killed.
Yeah. So rumors or stories of Billy the Kid's ghost were probably immediate. But stories that he wasn't dead at all, I think those didn't start to pop up until the 1920s, 1930s, most likely. Because that's when the idea of the Old West finally started to be romanticized. And people really became interested in it. So that's when there were the stories of Brushy Bill Roberts and these other men who claimed that they were Billy the Kid.
I mean, you can tell that there's something going on because, I mean, you've got some incredible photos in the book, which is one of those things I think sometimes, John, we forget that the late 19th century was, people were still getting used to using cameras and photography. And you see the old westerns where you see the guy carrying the massive bag and the enormous flash and everybody has to stand about. And it's almost like magic to these guys out there. But you can see in some of these pictures, I mean, there's one of the courthouse where they put a sign up and it mentions something about Billy the Kid, the famous desperado. And that's like 100 years ago. So clearly already, as you say, this kind of looking back at that particular period, even though it was only like 50 years prior to it, John, is that when it really started to kind of be a money spinner for places like Lincoln County?
Yeah, so when it really took off as a moneymaker was a man named Walter Noble Burns, a more famous author. He wrote his version of the Lincoln County War, which he called The Saga of Billy the Kid, and it sold exceptionally well. It was sort of a literary sensation in the late 1920s, and it was at that point that people who lived in Fort Sumner, where Billy the Kid was buried, they noticed these cars would be driving around the cemetery trying to find the grave, and they didn't even have a marker for him at that time. And so that's when places like Fort Sumner and Lincoln, you know, the light bulb went off that, oh, we can make money off of this, and people are interested and they want to see it.
So was it a case that the area, like you said, because I think people will always presume he was buried in Lincoln County, but he is at Fort Sumner, which is obviously quite a famous location anyway.
Yeah.
Because of its history to the American Civil War. It does seem to be one of those things that, did they just then decide to put a marker down and give him a headstone? Because there are lots of characters of that Old West era, these outlaws and train robbers and the like, where it seems at the immediate aftermath of their crimes or their punishment has reached fruition, John, the authorities don't want to do anything. And then 40, 50 years later, is this when it starts that people start to give these people gravestones and markers and they become historical tourist destinations?
Yes. So initially, right after Billy the Kid was shot and buried, one of his so-called girlfriends and her brother were joking around about Billy the Kid's ghost in the cemetery. And he said, I bet you're not brave enough to go out there to Billy's grave at midnight. And so she not only did that, she went out to the grave and she ripped his cross out of the ground and took it back to the house with her as proof, which I don't know how much she really loved him if she'd yank his cross out of the ground and, you know, just to win a bet. But that's the story, because his initial grave marker was two fence posts nailed together to make a cross with his name painted on it. And, you know, they put it back after the girlfriend stole it. But after that, soldiers started using it for target practice. They thought that would be neat. And then later, I think whoever bought the Fort Sumner properties that the cemetery was on, it was the New England Cattle Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought it was cool enough. They just straight up stole the cross and took it back to Boston with them because they thought it was cool. So his grave was unmarked for many, many years. And then in the 1920s is when they decided to create a monument for him. And that was actually very controversial because to some of the old timers, it was like, well, you're glorifying a criminal to the youth and we don't like it and you shouldn't promote him. So it was kind of a political thing, or kind of like akin to a political argument as to whether or not they should spend money on a formal monument to Billy the Kid.
Hmm. Well, I suppose it would be, but it's one of those things I think sometimes you forget regardless that whatever he did and whichever side of the coin you think he was on, he still deserved the decency of a gravestone at the very mm-hmm. least. I mean, you would suggest in that era, John, Billy wasn't alone in not having a marker or anything, and most people, because of the time, it would be two pieces of wood nailed together with somebody's name just painted on it more often than not. But obviously headstones are a lot harder to steal, aren't they?
Yeah.
Than a wooden cross.
Although his has been stolen twice still, so it's interesting.
Well, yes, I remember seeing something about that. I remember seeing a story about somebody trying to get a ransom for it. And I was thinking, well, who's paying for that? Who's going to pay the ransom, you know? So which do you think comes first for Billy the Kid these days? The legend or the ghost, John? Do you think people come for the legend and find out about the ghost stories? Or do you think it happens whichever side you come at it from?
Yes, I think it's the legend first. And so when I did this book, Haunted Lincoln County, I call it panning for gold. Mm. So I go through all the different books on Billy the Kid. Every once in a while, they'll have a ghost story in it or a paranormal anecdote that relates to Billy. So that's why I call it panning for gold. Like the books you see behind me right here, you know, they've all got something in them. Mm. Like we were talking about Saga of Billy the Kid. It has a story about Billy the Kid's outlaw friend, Jesse Evans, how he was seen after he should have been dead hanging around Lincoln, and the Hispanic people called him a wraith, which is totally different from a ghost. And, you know, again, all these books have a little something tucked somewhere. And so all I really did was just compile them all into one volume.
Mm. Mm. I had to chuckle when you've got obviously that part about one of Billy's friends talking about how he loved to tell ghost stories. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that story started, I thought, I'm sure I've heard this somewhere before. And obviously, as you explain at the end, it's obviously Billy's version of a very well-known traditional ghost story about essentially a moral lesson wrapped up as a ghost story. And I know the story about the woman meeting the devil at a dance and coming to a sticky end. So I was quite surprised to see even in those days. I mean, that shows you how long that story's been around as well.
Do you
John,
have because a version of that story in England that's...
Not really, no. We don't tend to have stories like that where people kind of bump into the devil and have a dance. Okay. Usually here, if you meet somebody untoward who wants to have a dance, they're usually one of the fae.
Ah, one of the fairies, yeah.
Yeah. And you go and hang out and think, oh, you're having a great time. And then when you get away, you've realized you've been gone 3 years, not 3 hours.
Yeah.
Those kind of things. But it's kind of similar kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. The temptation of dance with strangers. You've got to be careful what you wish for, I suppose, John.
Yeah, so Billy, I think cowboys in general like to tell ghost stories sitting around the campfire. And in Hispanic culture, there's this story about the devil, and you can transplant it anywhere you want. And the story is usually that a girl wants to go to a dance on Good Friday, and it's blasphemous to go to a dance on Good Friday because that's disrespectful and all that. Or the parents just don't want their children going out to a dance because they're worried they'll be promiscuous. And the gist of the story, though, is that the girl goes to the dance anyways, and she meets this handsome stranger and starts to dance with him. And at some point during the dance, she'll look down and see that he has the feet of like a giant chicken or a giant bird, or he'll have hooves for feet and he'll have a tail. And eventually it's obviously that he was secretly the devil. And they'll usually make an religious exclamation like Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and he'll disappear in a puff of smoke. So basically, Billy the Kid loved to hang out with the Hispanic peoples of New Mexico. He picked up their stories, and just like the Hispanic people did themselves, he would transplant them to his location. So he made up the same exact story. He said it in the village of Lincoln, and he tied it in with the Lincoln County War by saying that after the war was over, the people had gotten particularly immoral, and the husbands and the wives weren't faithful to each other, and that's why the devil popped up at the dance. And so it's interesting that even he, you know, told these stories himself.
Mm. Mm. Well, I suppose it's, as you say, it's that kind of campfire scenario that these guys are out there on their own, and often they had nothing but their own exploits and scary stories to keep them entertained on quiet nights, I suspect, John.
Yep, absolutely.
I had to raise an eyebrow or two, one of the other stories, which is this rather gruesome story about the poor chap who was hung and he wasn't quite dead. Now,
yeah.
This is one of those where it seems like an absolute comedy, but obviously, this is also tied in with Billy the Kid, because obviously some of the characters involved in the Lincoln County War were involved in this as well, because, as we said, there's no good guys in this story, really. You had this kind of situation going on where it seemed that somebody had paid for a hitman to take out somebody else that I think it's Murphy who was one of the main sort of protagonists in this.
Yeah, Murphy's the big head bad guy of the whole thing.
Yes.
He's the final boss, as the kids would say in video games.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so this seems to be one of those where you've got this guy who's clearly got massive influence over the whole area going up against the authorities. And also, once again, there seems to be a lot of pushback from people in and around Fort Sumner here. This almost descends into another war again, because obviously this guy gets hung for this hitman. He's hung by the guy who allegedly employed him.
Yes,
which is peculiar. The man he killed had his last rites read by the man that had paid the hitman to murder him, because he was a trainee priest and apparently the priest wasn't around.
Oh, yeah. So Major Murphy actually trained for the priesthood. So Major Murphy presided over the funeral of the very man that he had killed. And they just didn't know that he was, you know, the man, the puppet master in the dark pulling the string. So even if ghosts aren't involved, just the history of the Lincoln County War is very macabre.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You could say this Murphy was just running it like some kind of Machiavellian plan to... He seemed to be involved in everything, John.
Yes, yeah.
Goodness me. But yes, so this chap, Murphy hangs him, but obviously there seems to be a bit of a rush, and we've seen cases like this from around the world with hangings where the rope snaps or the trapdoor doesn't work. This chap seems to be one of those poor unfortunates that they hang him for quite a considerable period of time and they just presume, well, he's dead now.
Yeah.
They put him in the coffin, and then one of the bystanders decides, well, that coffin doesn't look quite open, I'm going to have a look at that, which is even stranger.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's the kind of place you have to go far to come across a dead body now and again, John.
No, uh-uh.
And when she opens the coffin, she realises he's still alive, and then there's this big argument saying, oh, well, he's been hung, and if he survived, he'll be okay. And then Murphy's like, no, we've got to save him. Clearly trying to look after the guy who's worked for him. But then the guys from Fort Sumner went, no, no. And just hang him and drag him out the coffin with the noose. It's incredible when you read your description of what the events were.
Yeah, the twice hung man, William Wilson. So yeah, the lady who peered into the coffin saw that he was still breathing. And some people thought Major Murphy wanted it that way. And he botched the hanging on purpose so that he could save him. But nobody knows. They just know that the people wanted justice, and Murphy argued from a legal standpoint that technically he had been hung and they couldn't hang him again because the sentence had been carried. And so what if he didn't die? But the people wouldn't have it. They made sure he was hung again, and they let him hang for quite a while to make sure he was dead.
I mean, it's you can only imagine the scenes.
Yeah.
Goodness me. I mean, was it one of those things? Because obviously public executions here in the UK were quite popular when they were held in public. And it's just before this period we're talking about in the States, John, that they were outlawed and done in private after that. Primarily because there used to be fights and all sorts kicking off. But you would get thousands. And I think when people look back at their perception of the West as it was, unless you've really sort of studied the period and read and been to the locations, most people's knowledge is based on what they've seen in films, I suspect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Westerns have been one of the most popular genres in the history of cinema, still to this very day. Some of my favourite films of the last 30 years have been outstanding Westerns. And so when you look at a film, whenever there's a hanging or whatever, there always seems to be, the whole town seems to come out. Was that the case in this particular era, John? Or is it that kind of thing where, that once again, the films are romanticising the kind of attraction to it? Or, because it was such a desolate town miles from anywhere in that period, it was classed as entertainment for the townsfolk?
No, I think it's accurate that they all turned out and it was entertainment for them. Absolutely. I mean, it was a grotesque sense of fascination for some of them, but like for the ones who had been wronged by whoever was being hung, you know, for them that was seeing justice being done and so on.
I know when before we started, you mentioned Billy the Kid's connections with the UK and England. So what ties him? Obviously, as you mentioned earlier, Tunstall is famous for what being one of these kind of cattle barons at the time who had moved there from England. So what ties Billy back then?
There's two. One of the interesting ones is, you know, as we said before, there were several different men who claimed that they were Billy the Kid, not just Brushy Bill Roberts. And one of these men, I don't remember his name, but there was a story that Tunstall's family in England invited the surviving Billy the Kid to go and live with them, and then that this old man who was really Billy the Kid died and was buried in England. And so that's a folk tale, but it's not a very common one, and there's not a lot to it. And the other interesting tie to Billy the Kid and Great Britain is that the most famous Billy the Kid researcher and author was from England, and that was Frederick Nolan, and he wrote many of the best books on the Kid, and I had the pleasure of meeting him a couple of times. He would come out here to Roswell to stay at a friend's house while he would do research and tour around Lincoln and stuff, so a lot of Billy's history was actually preserved by an Englishman.
Which just shows his power to attract anybody from any part of the world, really, John.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as you mentioned about his supposed escape and moving to England, did they ever say where he was supposed to be buried here in England?
Yes, but I'd have to look. I just can't remember. And it's not in Haunted Lincoln. It's in Tall Tales of Billy the Kid is where that story appears.
Right. I've never come across that before. That was quite surprising. I knew Tunstall was English, strangely enough.
Yeah.
Because I know there was a few guys in that era who had moved from the UK out to America and has kind of set up farms and stuff. So that didn't surprise me when I learned. And obviously knowing a bit about Billy and seeing things over the years, I knew that Tunstall was always an Englishman. So, but yeah, I never knew that about him in being offered a route out of the New World back to England.
Yeah.
I think that one of the most interesting stories is one that I've never really come across before, which is this marvellous tale about the ghost steer.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of those things when you read it, you start to think, well, we have ghost stories about near enough every other kind of animal out there, John. Why shouldn't we have a ghostly steer terrifying people? But this one seems to be a very specific and special one, depending on the fortitude of the people that encountered it.
So that's what's funny about that. You know, this book is for the History Press. They do a ton of these haunted books. And, you know, you always have an editor and a proofreader. And the proofreader on this one really went out of her way to say, wow, I've never seen in all the books I've done for the History Press, and there's a lot of them, she's like, I've never seen a ghost steer. That's crazy. So I guess it really does stand out. But the story goes, briefly, you know, Billy the Kid had a rivalry with this cowboy named Pecos Bob Olinger. He was, you know, if Murphy was the big boss, then I guess Olinger would be kind of like the henchman in the James Bond movie, like Jaws or something. You know, because James Bond, there was always the secondary henchman who was big and burly and had a gimmick. Well, that would probably be Pecos Bob Olinger, because he and Billy the Kid really hated each other. And the story went that Bob Olinger was riding along the river, and he came across a maverick steer that he knew belonged to John Chisholm. And per the legend, he branded it with a skull and crossbones, and then he cursed it to roam the ranges forever. And my only real problem with that story is who carries around a skull and crossbones brand to brand a random cow that they find. But that's the story. That's the nature of these stories. And he cursed the steer, and the steer supposedly, not long after that, Billy the Kid killed Bob Olinger, and that he was the first victim of the curse of the ghost steer. And this ghost steer would just pop up along the range anytime. I mean, he was basically like the bad omen of the range is that if you saw this steer, you or somebody with you was about to die. And it went on for years and years, and they got tired of it. And instead of, you know, again, this is the illogical part of the story. You know, I mean, if they're so worried about this cursed steer, why don't they just kill it? Well, instead of killing it, they decided, well, let's ship them off to Texas. Let's, you know, ship them off to the meat markets, you know, for slaughter. And the story went that they drove the ghost steer and this herd to Amarillo, to the train stations there, unloaded them onto the train, and he was going to get shipped off to the eastern markets for slaughter. But after they rode back to Fort Sumner, they received word that the train crashed right after it left, and men died and cattle died, but they couldn't find the cursed steer. It got loose. And then many, many years later, you know, when it should have been dead of natural causes, people were still seeing its ghost, and it was, you know, flickering in the night sky and all these things. And so, it, you know, again, it was just the de facto omen of the range that if you saw this steer, you know, somebody was going to die.
I know in that section of the book, one of the things, as you mentioned, about this allegedly cursed steer is when this train crash happens on the way to Amarillo, the locals are so terrified they move the entire town. Is that true?
It's true that they moved the entire town, but that's just folklore in terms of it being because of the ghost. Really, they just built it in the wrong spot, which was in a lake bed that would fill with water when it flooded. But I did at least go through the newspaper records because they gave the year of the accident as 1888, and I found that there were at least two big train accidents outside of Amarillo in 1888 where the train derailed and men were killed and cattle were killed. So that possibly did happen.
Well, we've actually found a 40 and go train crash that occurred, John. That's a rare thing.
Yeah.
So did Amarillo move at that period then, John? I mean, obviously, building a town in a lake bed is not the wisest of ideas. Because I would imagine, as with anywhere, yes, it doesn't rain very often in the particular area, but I would imagine it's one of those places that when it rains, it's not very much fun if you live in where the lake drains into.
Yes, and I've been to Amarillo, but not living there, I assume that's correct. I say that because I hear other people talk about Roswell, and I'm like, well, that's close to the truth, but that's not really right. So, I mean, I'm probably close to the truth, but I doubt I'm dead on.
So, do you think it was one of those that, because it was quite an intriguing-looking creature, its reputation preceded it? Or because it was all wrapped up in the legend of Billy the Kid and Chisholm and everybody, that helped its supernatural reputation grow, John? Because I know some people claim that the steer is one of the reasons that the war started in the first place.
Yes, and again, just total folklore in regards to that. And why the steer, its name was Old Ruidoso, why it had so many unique brands was they had such a thing back then as a decoy steer, where they would brand it in a spot where you couldn't really see the brand. And it was kind of a form of entrapment where someone would see it and they might honestly think that it was just a maverick with no owner and they would brand it. But then the owner could then, you know, point to their original brand and say, oh, see, there's our brand. We got you, you criminal, and now you're under arrest. So it was kind of a gotcha thing, kind of deceptive. And that's what Old Ruidoso started out as, was a decoy steer. And so, like, some people think the reason it got so many brands on it was, you know, just out of the animosity for decoy steers in general. And they said they put snakes and scorpion brands on it. So if it really existed, it must have been pretty unique. And I don't know if that steer ever really existed, but if you come to Roswell, we have a statue, though, of that particular steer, Old Ruidoso, and it's right across from our courthouse. So that at least does exist.
So when did the ghost turn up? Because obviously, as with anything, it had a reputation as being bad luck and a cursed animal. There's another guy who hears of its reputation, decides to kill it, and as he goes to shoot it, his horses get spooked and he dies.
Yeah,
So how long is it till the ghost starts turning up? Because it also seems to have a real effect on people, because I know there's one chap who apparently sees it near Fort Sumner who essentially gets driven mad. And people say as he's dying, he starts acting like the steer.
Yeah.
As though he's turning into some kind of animal before he passes away, which doesn't sound particularly nice for him or anybody who had to witness it.
The ghostly aspect of him, like, as, you know, Ruidoso being an actual ghost, was the late 1890s, and he was allegedly seen in the skies prior to New Mexico's greatest disappearance of all time. In 1896, a lawyer named Albert Fountain rode across White Sands in his buckboard, and he disappeared. They've never found his body. They just found his buckboard, and they've never found his body or the body of his son that was with him. And the lore says that the night before he disappeared, he and someone with him saw old Ruidoso up in the sky as the final omen.
Well, that's one of those mysteries as well. Do you think that's one of those that it gets added to the story? Because the fact that this guy and his son died, well, we think they died because nobody's ever, as you say, there's no trace ever been found of them. Because I think, was his son 8 years old with him as well?
Yeah, I don't think they really saw old Ruidoso in the skies, if I'm being honest. I do believe the stories that they know who killed Albert Fountain, and that man, the man who killed the little boy, was haunted. I didn't put this story in haunted Lincoln County because it doesn't take place in Lincoln County. It takes place in a neighboring county, but the man accused of killing the 8-year-old son that was with Albert Fountain, he had a nightmare where he went to hell and his legs got drenched in like lava. And when he woke up from the dream, his legs had like burn scars on them. And that's, I mean, I didn't see it. That was a long time ago, but the people act like that was a true event, that he woke up with burn scars on his legs. So that's an interesting haunting.
Absolutely. Some would say much deserved as well, John. Not many people would, because obviously I think the thing about the Fountain disappearance is the fact that he'd gone to the courthouse to serve writs on people once again. And so you would suggest that he was murdered because of that, not because of old Ruidoso.
Yeah. And actually the whole reason the family wanted him to take the 8-year-old son with him, because their logic was, who would hurt an 8-year-old little boy? That'll serve as his protection, and it didn't.
Yes, you have to be careful who you may have crossed in those days. It's,
yeah.
Yes, morals were not high on some people's lists, it would seem, John.
No.
And he's probably not the only person who would have done something as heinous as that, I suspect.
Yeah.
Sadly. I mean, one of the other aspects of this particular area is obviously you've got this cross-pollination of cultures in New Mexico because of its proximity to the border. And obviously, La Llorona is another resident of the state, and especially Lincoln County. As we said, I think last time we were speaking, it amazes me how entrenched La Llorona is across the whole sort of southern U.S., especially on the western side. You can find stories, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California. There seems to be a real grounding point for the stories about this particular character all throughout that area, but New Mexico seems to be a bit richer.
Absolutely, yeah, because New Mexico is more Hispanic, arguably, than like Texas or Arizona. And so New Mexico, pretty much every village has its own version of La Llorona. I mean, even last night, my mom was telling me about the bridge where she went as a teenager and had some boy told her about La Llorona, and this is where she hangs out. So everybody has it, but Lincoln County's La Llorona, in that case, the mother didn't drown her own children, which is usually the origin story for her. In that case, the Bonito River was flooding, and she didn't take enough precautions to protect her children from the flood, and they got washed away in the river, and she was consumed with grief and decided to just die along with them. And now something interesting is that in Texas, La Llorona always has the head of a horse or of a donkey. And here in Lincoln County as well, it's one of the rare instances of her having a horse's head in New Mexico as opposed to Texas. And that occurs in the little village of Capitan, which is nearby Lincoln.
Yes. Well, once again, Capitan is quite a famous town as well. I think my grandfather's got a lot to answer for, making me watch a lot of westerns when I was growing up, I think, John. Because I seem to know these places that are in this book, which is one of those you just think, why do I know this? And it's all because my grandfather used to, that's all he did when he retired. He loved westerns.
Oh, neat.
So I've seen most of the great and quite a lot of the bad. But yes, these places like Capitan and Lincoln County are just synonymous for me with that particular era. And so I wasn't surprised to see that La Llorona had moved across. But obviously, why do you think she's got this kind of animalistic aspect to it, more so than, say, some of the more well-known stories?
I think the idea was that as punishment, because she was very beautiful typically in life, as punishment, she was given the head of a horse or a mule in the afterlife. I think that's the idea.
So in regards to how she behaves in other areas, what marks her out differently other than the fact that she's cursed with a horse or a donkey's head? Does she still carry on in the same way, sort of chasing people and chastising those that seem to be lacking some moral behaviors?
Yes, she's used as a cautionary tale also against like wayward husbands who are out drinking late at night. So in addition to children, you know, playing too close to the edge of the irrigation ditch or the river, she's also like a cautionary tale for men that are out too late drinking.
And she also seems to be one of those stories that, I know you mention an excerpt from a book that talks about a ghost wandering around the streets late at night. As you say, once again, probably being used as a reason to keep people home or away from the saloon.
Yeah, and in that one, they didn't call her La Llorona. She was just a woman in white, but I feel like she was definitely based on La Llorona because it was the county seat of Lincoln, which is named Carrizozo, and I think that's where that one was cited.
Mm. Has she continued to make her presence felt in the modern era, John, or is this one of those that we're looking back at stories from 100, 150 years ago, or is she still encountered? Do people still claim to run into her?
Yes, La Llorona is still encountered. She's probably, as a legend, growing instead of like shrinking away, because some of these old Hispanic legends, they just kind of fade into obscurity. Like there's one called the Abuelo, which is basically Bigfoot, but nobody talks about that one anymore. But La Llorona and the Lechuza, which is like an owl woman, they're as popular as they've ever been, and the stories are still spreading.
Do you think she's? I mean, we've said this before. I think she's clearly the most famous Hispanic Mexican haunting or spirit that we're aware of. Are you surprised that she still has such power? Because it is remarkable, I think. Maybe it's because I'm looking at it from outside the US, John, but I'm amazed how much she permeates those particular states, as I mentioned. And obviously, one can only imagine how many stories there are about her in Mexico.
Yeah, it's, I think there's a lot of interpretation in La Llorona about female grief and motherhood and maybe also like postpartum depression, because in many cases La Llorona, she can't handle her children and they get to be too much for her and she drowns them on purpose. But again, in other stories though, it's not on purpose, it's by accident. So I don't know, people just, they like to take that story and change it to, you know, their own village. And you know, in the 1980s you could even see it kind of shifting, because one of them was kind of more of a slasher. It kind of reminded me of a slasher movie. That one was from, I think it was from Tucson, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one, it was the husband didn't want the children and he hacked them up into little pieces with an axe. And then, so I think outside of Tucson, La Llorona carries like an axe or a butcher knife and she's going to cut you up to replace her dead children. You know, and like, but for me, you know, I can see where, okay, it was the 1980s, those movies were really popular, and somebody, that was their version of La Llorona.
Yes. I mean, that went, That reminds me, there is an actual horrible true story, I think, from Wisconsin, where they have a famous murder house up there. And the mother there, I think, drowned the children, I think. And people see her wandering around with an axe.
Hmm. So, well, yeah. Since we're talking about the 1980s, I just remembered in Texas, a woman really did drown her children. And I think she was declaring herself as insane, but she identified herself as La Llorona to the police.
I've read about that. That's, I mean, you would suggest, like you say, maybe it was a bit of postnatal depression, which even back in the 1980s was something that really wasn't accepted, you would suggest.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's amazing the power that it still has. And like you say, I think as time goes by, she seems to adapt to the circumstances that we find ourselves in often, you would imagine. And so I would imagine, not that I'm suggesting we could, but maybe it would be nice to know what her story is in 100 years, John, how her origin story has changed. Is it now that she's had an accident in her flying car and her children have died?
Well, okay. And see, that's another one. In California, her origin story is along something called Snake Road because it snakes a lot. And I think she was driving too fast. So that is a story where she drove her car into the river and it sank. And
that's scuppered my plans for the time machine, John. We don't need that then. That's clearly the next step. I mean, like you say, I mean, it seems that the origin story was she murdered her children, but I know this one in Lincoln County is more to do that they died accidentally in a flood.
Yeah.
And that's what changed it. But then you've got a car accident. Is there any other kind of origin changes to this?
And the one in Lincoln County or just in general?
In general.
So in general, I'll be shameless just because I need to eat and make money and say, like, I have a whole book on La Llorona, which I know Paul has, but people listening may not have it. So yeah, I have a whole book on La Llorona. It's called Her Kith and Kin, and it's all the different variations and different origin stories and other spirits that are kind of tangent to her, because there's a male version. And there's also the ghosts of her children can sometimes become monsters as well. And it's, there's a lot to it.
Mm. There doesn't seem to be any end to how she may become La Llorona, it would seem, John.
Yeah.
Hellhounds are a strange thing. I'm still scratching my head about how many there really are, because it seemed I was completely blindsided about this. Because I think often the paranormal tends to kind of say that certain things only live in certain countries. And I think once you start to read and meet people from other places, you suddenly realise that that's a load of nonsense. Because obviously Britain is synonymous, I suspect, with the Black Shucks. Mm-hmm. And the devil dogs, or whatever people want to call it, hellhounds they're known as in certain places here, John. But there seems to be a real sort of history in this particular area as well, once again from the Mexican peoples, that seem to have a real sort of fear of this. And then you've got at least two examples of hellhound stories in this latest book.
Yeah, so near Lincoln is this old military fort called Fort Stanton. And it was initially the reservation where they would detain and oversee the Mescalero Apache, and they've since moved on to a different area. But Fort Stanton remained, and after it transitioned from being, you know, a Native American reservation, it became a tuberculosis hospital and just a Navy hospital in general. I think during World War II, it had some prisoners of war. So it has a long storied history. There's a lot of ghosts at Fort Stanton. And again, I mean, for anybody who's touring New Mexico, it's right next to Lincoln. It's another monument that's very well preserved. You can walk around a period accurate 1800s era fort and look around. So there's obviously a lot of ghosts there for different reasons. They have shadow people there, which is kind of a newer type of ghost. But the one that I was most interested in is they have a chapel. And around the chapel, they claim to see either kind of like a werewolf-type creature or a quadruped, you know, on all fours type of dog creature. And it just has a lot of ghostly attributes. And I wouldn't believe it, except for I knew the site director fairly well, because every time I would go to Lincoln, I would visit him. His name is Tim Roberts. Mm-hmm. Very respectable guy. Not really into fringe stuff or ghost stories. He was very accurate whenever he would give lectures on Lincoln or Billy the Kid, and he would always dispel folklores and myths, you know, and he was very much about the facts.
Yeah.
But he and his crew at Fort Stanton were adamant that, yes, people saw this weird dog creature around the chapel, and it was always around the chapel, nowhere else. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to be more of a ghost or something supernatural or like a cryptid. It just wasn't a dog, but it was certainly a dog-like creature. And then the Ghost Hunters, the TV show, came to Lincoln, and they went inside the chapel, and they recorded knocks on the pews. And so then they started to just ask the ghost question. Whatever ghost was knocking on the pews, they would say, well, let's let one knock be yes and two knocks be no. And they would ask it questions. And I think they asked it about the dog creature. And they asked it, is it like a bad entity, or is it just like, you know, a dog spirit? And the implication seemed to be that it was just like a dog spirit, and it wasn't like a monster out to, you know, eat anyone. And so here's another interesting thing. So like in England with Black Shuck and the Hellhounds, and also just like amongst like Caucasian Anglo culture, the Hellhounds are always evil. They can only be bad. But the Mescalero Apache and some of the Native American tribes, they have dogs that are kind of like good spirit creatures that like guard holy places. And then the Hispanic culture, I really love this. In addition to the evil hellhound, and they call those cadejos. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you say it, cadejo or something. And in addition to the evil black cadejo, they have a white cadejo, which is like a heaven hound, I guess. You know, it's like an angelic good hound that if you're lost in the woods, it'll help you find your way back. And so I just think it's so cool they have, you know, a good spirit dog to counter the bad one.
I suppose as well, it's one of those, because, I mean, when I saw those stories, the first thing that popped into my head was the stories of cadejos.
Yeah.
But obviously this one seems to be quite different, because most of those cadejos are essentially giant wolves, it would sound, John, in what I've read in some of your works and other people in regards to talking about these particular beliefs and legends. And so when you come across the white one, it seems quite strange. You don't tend to get that very often. But this one in Lincoln County, as you say, people seem to see it standing up, walking around bipedally, which straight away then thinks, is this one of those werewolf dogmen that doesn't get mentioned with the rest of them? Because people focus on the fact that it's tied to the Cadejo legend, which is more to do with wolves rather than werewolves.
Yeah, there's just not enough to go on with that one. And the problem is, usually people who see these things aren't terribly well educated on the supernatural. That's what seems to usually happen. So when they give an account of one of these things, it would be totally different if like someone like you or me saw it, and we could be like, oh, that's a dog man as opposed to a werewolf, because there is a difference. Most people don't know that there is, but there is. You know, or you could be like, oh, that's a hellhound, or that's a ghost, or... And I think that's the problem. I think everybody who's seen this thing, they're not super familiar with the supernatural apart from just generalized ghosts and werewolves and all that stuff.
The other story that you mention, other than this strange werewolf type thing that's wandering around, is this other one that once again seems to behave more like the Shuck legend, where it chases people. But you've also, as you cover in the in bit portion in the book where you talk about this, you've got once again somebody attending a dance on a on a religious day, which is frowned upon, and has a run-in with this creature. But then you also have people telling their own tribal stories and tribal legends in regards to this, and you have bands around their neck as though that sort of sets it out to make it stand out, so people know exactly who this creature is. And this is another one which I was surprised to see ties into the Apache shamanism believes.
Yeah, per the Mescalero Apache, I think if the dog has like a ring around its neck, like a white, I can't remember if it's a white ring or a black ring, that can mean it's like a guard, or like a guard of the spirit realm or something, or it's a guardian of a sacred place. And that's why some people have thought that maybe it's the one at Fort Stanton is, you know, somehow tied in with the Mescalero Apache because they were detained there for a while. Then the other hellhound was from a little settlement called Picacho, where, again, the guy went to the dance on Good Friday like he wasn't supposed to, and the hellhound, I think, chased him home or something. I get mixed up because I also just did another book for the same publisher called, well, I don't know what we're going to call it yet, but tentatively it's Monsters of New Mexico, and it has a lot of hellhound entries in it. And so they're all mixed up in my brain right now, so I can't keep them straight, but they're all generally similar. And there's a lot of them from New Mexico specifically, which is interesting.
Mm. Do you think this is more because it's tied into Hispanic beliefs and therefore these are sometimes the stories that get overlooked, John, because there isn't either the cultural pollination of these stories or people just pass them as word of mouth, as a lot of the tribal nations passed on their legends, or it's once again funny dog creatures are quite popular now in the world of the paranormal, and it's only now that we're kind of getting these stories that have probably been around forever.
So these ones come from a book where the folklore was all collected back in the 1950s for the most part. So the stories, the accounts are usually old-timey accounts, like, which probably meant like the early 1900s that the, you know, the old-timers of the 1950s gave to these historians.
Hmm. Was it one of those projects that you see a lot of places, sort of the 1930s, 1940s, John, where people were going out to try and record stories because they knew that certain locations and certain populations just didn't write things down? It was all oral.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's basically right.
Mm. It does strike me as quite peculiar. It seems like such a rich seam of paranormal belief that we barely know about, really. And it seems that, like you say, the more you look, the more you find. And it's that may sound like common sense, but often I don't think people would associate so many hellhound stories with that particular area.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, even for you as an archivist, John, and a wonderful researcher as you are, and as you've proved in your numerous books in several fields, are you surprised to see how many there are that it's this prevalent? Because you could probably say, really, it's the one thing behind La Llorona.
Yeah, that's a tough one. All those myths do certainly have a root cause, though. And I mean, with the hellhounds, though, I mean, if all these stories are true, I don't see why they'd be making them up. But now, see, that's the problem with people like me and you, though. I don't think you or I would ever make up a fake story about seeing a UFO or a devil dog. So when somebody tells that story to us, our psychology is, well, I wouldn't make up a story like that, so they must be telling the truth. You know, yeah. So it's hard to say, especially with written accounts, because you don't know the person. Mm. One of the best paranormal accounts I've ever gotten, like face-to-face, where I could look into the witness's eyes, was a night nurse at the New Mexico Rehab Center, which was formerly the hospital on the base here at Roswell where the UFO bodies were taken and all that. And she did talk about seeing a small statured ghost with a big head wrapped in bandages, and just, you know, to be with her and have a read on her energy, which I really liked, because I think when you're like with a person, you know, in the same space, you can get a sense of their energy and just who they really are. You know, I believed her story. I still do, you know. So when you're actually interviewing the witness, it's different than just reading it on paper. And it was, you know, 100 years ago now. You really can't tell anything from that other than just, well, it's a story and it's in print and who knows.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's quite interesting because I've got the opposite to that. I was speaking to somebody fairly recently at an event, and they were telling me about all these stories about people claiming that to see people transform into chupacabras, John, which I've never come across. And I just burst out laughing.
Yeah, I've never heard that either.
I just thought, that's absolute nonsense. Where on earth have you found this? And he's like, oh yeah, I've watched this documentary on YouTube. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I've never come across. Now, I might be wrong, John, but it's not something I've ever come across. And certainly, as far as I'm aware, whichever version of a chupacabra you think it is, either the Texas Blue Dog or the strange alien-like creature from Puerto Rico, I've never come across a case where someone's claimed to see somebody change into one.
And me neither.
Very. So, yes, there's horses for courses. Yeah. You give me a good story and I'll kind of give you the opposite there. So, yes, yeah. I think you're right, though. I think often it's the emotion of someone telling the tale you can tell. And usually, sometimes they're quite mundane. It doesn't do anything. You know, it's weird and it maybe frightens somebody because it either appears out of nowhere or it catches them unawares. But more often than not, nothing terrifying happens. And it's usually when people start adding whistles and bells and all that, that it starts to get a little bit silly, if you know what I mean. And I think you've got a silly box, really. And you can certainly see things edging closer to that the more exaggerated it gets.
Yeah.
Well, the last case I want to mention, because there's so many in this, John, I could keep you here forever, buddy, because it's a brilliant collection of wonderful stories. As I say, because I love a book where you learn so much about things and you discover a bit of, as you do with everything, a bit of scare, a bit of history, a bit of murder and mayhem. It seems like the perfect combination for a John Le May book about these things. My friend. But you've got this rather gruesome, as I said at the beginning about Billy the Kid and the whole Lincoln County War, you've got this, the Benito City massacres. So for anybody who's not aware of this and what happened, what are the Benito City massacres? What caused it and what happened afterwards?
So this was shortly after the Lincoln County War, and it was about the year 1885, and Benito City was one of the most peaceful little western villages you could imagine. They were kind of teetotalers, I think that's the word. They didn't like to drink there. You know, they didn't have violence there. They didn't have cowboys shooting up the saloon because they didn't really have a saloon, really. You know, just a very peaceful, God-fearing community. And they had a boarding house there. And one night, totally at random, this boarder wakes up, he gets a gun, and he kills everyone he possibly can. And when it's all over, about 7 people are dead, and it, you know, by the next morning, the other townspeople figured out what was happening, and they shoot the mysterious boarder in the head and kill him. And, you know, for years and years thereafter, people say they don't know why he did it, and he was such a nice guy. Why did he snap and kill all these people in the night? We just have no idea. And, you know, of course, with something like that, there's a lot of ghost stories. But what I'm the most proud of in regards to that one, I think I actually connected some dots and figured some stuff out, because typically, I will admit, I usually am just pouring old wine into new bottles. You know, these stories have been around a long time, but like maybe you, Paul, you know, you don't know this story, but I know this story from the book on the shelf behind me that's really obscure that nobody's cracked open in 50 years. But because I'm a book nerd, I have it and I see it. And so I just take the story from this book and, you know, paraphrase it and reprint it, you know, for a new generation, which, you know, nothing wrong with that. But with this Benito City massacre, though, I think maybe I came across the motive. Because, again, people for years, they would say, oh, we don't know why this guy just started killing people. So there's this old book of folklore. It's very obscure. It's the one that has all the hellhound stories in it. The authors interviewed about 3 different families in the nearby town of Capitan about the murders and the ghosts. They wanted the ghost stories. But in talking about the ghosts, they kind of really implied, when you put all 3 testimonies together, you really get the impression that the murderer was probably a gay man who was mocked, you know, for being gay, and also there would have appeared to have been some sort of a relationship between he and one of the boarders in the house. And you can't really say whether it was consensual or not, or what the context of the relationship was. But when you put it all together and really examine the story based on their testimony, it does seem like a man who snapped and just went on a killing spree, and that may have actually been the reason. and it had something to do with that. So, because again, most people just say, well, it was completely random. We have no idea, you know, why he snapped and went off the deep end. And I kind of think that maybe writers of the 1930s and 40s and 50s may have heard that, but back then that was so taboo they wouldn't touch it.
Mm.
And so they kind of just brushed that aspect of the story under the rug.
Mm.
Because when they talked about the ghost, they would say the ghost was really preoccupied with the grave of one of the guys. And he was always trying to, the ghost was always trying to get into this grave, and the killing always had to do with this other guy. So it was just kind of eyebrow raising. And so I don't know if that's the reason, but it's a better reason than anything that's ever been given before for this mysterious massacre.
Mm. Well, this is the thing, because it's horrendous, mm-hmm. really. I mean, especially the first incident, because as you say in this, people said, oh, he was just a drifter, but it clearly, everybody knew who this guy was.
Yeah, and I looked at the newspaper records, and so the idea that he was a drifter was created retroactively. He was actually a fairly longtime resident of the city. And again, the papers of the time would even say he was well-liked and everybody liked him. But some of the old-timers in their kind of rarely given, rarely printed recollections said he was made fun of and mocked because he was, quote, effeminate. That was what they said in their interviews. But yeah, I think some people like to say that he got possessed in the night, but I think that was just authors trying to create a fantastic story and kind of add some supernatural flourishes to it. But they said, yeah, he got possessed by the devil in the middle of the night, and that's why he did it. But irregardless of, you know, why he did it, there's a lot of ghosts at the location. And what I forgot to mention is the town was so traumatized by the event that after a while, nobody wanted to move there, and the people that lived there kind of moved away when they could, and the town just died a slow death. And it was in a natural little valley that they dammed up, and they made a lake out of it, a man-made lake. So today, people oftentimes will go there and go fishing, and it's like a natural water reservoir for nearby towns. Contrary to myth, the ghost town is not underneath the water. You know, back then they liked to reuse their lumber, you know, so they dismantled the town and took the good lumber and used it to rebuild other structures elsewhere. But yeah, so this lake is basically where this town resided that's just soaked in blood. And, you know, the ghost stories are that if you look into the water, you can see the killer look back at you. And then there's lots of folklore that they buried the killer head first in the ground, like upside down, you know, with his head pointed down, so that way his spirit couldn't rise back up and haunt people, even though allegedly it still does. And but yeah, that's the whole point of the History Press's Haunted America imprint. I'm sure people know about it just because there's so many of these books. And like you said, Paul, the great thing about them is you learn a lot of proven true history, and then sprinkled in with that is, you know, the ghosts that go with it. And so it doesn't have to be what they call a guilty pleasure, because you are learning true history, but you do get the fun stuff, which is the ghosts along with it.
Absolutely. I've always said, as someone that loves history and the paranormal, you come for the ghosts and you learn your history.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, well, the one thing that surprises me about this particular incident is that I can think of 50, 60 other heinous murders, massacres in America in that period going up to the 1930s. I've never heard of this till I read it. Hmm. And I don't understand why, because, I mean, he essentially nearly kills an entire family with a revolver. Yeah. And one of them somehow manages to survive, and nobody's really sure. I think, is it one of the daughter that survives?
Yeah, the daughter survived, and she you know, chose to move back east not long afterwards because she didn't want to be there. And then nobody really interviewed her after that. And if anybody could have, you know, really told the truth about that night, it was probably her. But again, just nobody ever interviewed her is the problem.
Mm. But also, as you were alluding to, people said, oh, well, he lost his mind, he got possessed, whatever. But after he killed anybody he came across in the hotel that he was staying in, that he was lodging in, He then decided to change weapons. He grabs a Winchester and starts wandering around shooting anybody he comes across. He goes to the saloon and shoots a couple more people. But then he knocks on somebody's door and asks them for a cup of coffee. And he promises not to hurt them. But he's apparently so shaky, he can't even hold his own coffee cup. So the lady who he's burst into holds it for him. He thanks her for it and he goes off and carries on. That does not sound like the behaviour of someone who's lost their mind. That sounds like someone, unfortunately, who has made a decision and it, whatever happens is going to happen, John.
Yeah, so many mysteries to the whole story. And the problem with old timers back then is they would oftentimes give contradicting stories. I mean, that's still true of people today, but it seemed even worse back then in terms of who shot who first and what order this happened and all that.
I mean, like, even how the shooter dies, there doesn't seem to be a correct narrative either. And once again, do you think this is once down to the fact that the only person who survived, nobody bothered to ask her about it, and therefore it's only the rest of the townsfolk who manage. I believe they corral him and eventually kill him within a few hours. But he still killed, like, what, another five or six people. So he's killed what?
No, he just killed seven total, I believe. Yeah.
Everybody else recovered. But he shot a lot, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, I think most of the killings were the husband and the wife, their two sons, one of their boarders, so that's five people. Mm-hmm. And then the other two were just residents of the town outside that started to fight back against him. Mm. And that's the other thing. He got the drop on these two guys that were gunning for him. You know, it's not like he snuck up on these guys and killed them. At least one of them, there was like a hand-to-hand fight that the killer won.
Yeah. So what legends occurred after he'd passed then? Is it one of those, like you say, because how long after the massacre and the people began to drift away and the town, as you say, essentially died, did the dam come then? And so what did the ghost story start before the dam, or is it this once again, John, one of those things that it's happened after the location is unavailable to visit?
No, the ghost story started happening not too long after the killings. According to a book called Mysteries and Miracles of New Mexico by Jack Cutts, although the bad thing about Jack Cutts was he didn't really use footnotes and he often didn't cite the sources, which is fine. Like, I believe Jack Cutts, but it would have been nice for our sake if he would have put in a footnote and said this account happened on this date. But Cutts kind of he liked to generalize and just say, well, one day this little girl was playing near where the murderer was gunned down and she saw blood flowing down the river, which wasn't too long after the killing, you know, probably a year later or something. And then another story is that they would hear gunshots going off in the hotel, you know, on the anniversary of the killing or just on certain nights. And some people say they never went inside the hotel to clean it and they left the blood everywhere. And then other people will say, oh yeah, they did clean the blood out, but then the blood would reappear and things like that. And again, there's not really good documentation on that. It's just oral history that somebody jotted down but didn't really say when it happened and all that. But the dam, though, for sure wasn't built until the 1930s, and the town had died, you know, well before that.
Well, it does surprise me, because knowing what I know about certain incidents in the Old West, I think a lot of them just got a bucket of water thrown over them most of the time, John. And so you've got blood stains all over the place. Yeah. I mean, Billy the Kid's supposed to have left blood stains somewhere, because I know, as we going back to what we started on, people have tried to DNA test that against family members, haven't they? So clearly this was a thing where you would... And to be fair, what would they clean it with? I would imagine some of these places didn't even have a proper floor.
Yeah, I don't know. See, now that's where I'm bad, as like a quote Old West historian. I don't know a lot of their technicalities. I just remember the stories in general.
But you would just think that they wouldn't have the hands on, you know, this is essentially the frontier, really. People hadn't really got much further than this at that particular period. I doubt they're going to have a lot of soap and bleach to hand, John, in Lincoln County in 1878, let's be honest.
Yeah. No, they wouldn't, yeah.
Well, once again, John, it's a wonderful collection of fabulous stories and legends and incidents.
Yeah, thank you.
Terrible, terrible crimes and ghosts associated with them. So what's next? I know you alluded to it. You're doing some more work alongside the History Press again, as well as your ongoing series. So what have you got going on for everybody to look forward to?
Well, I'll plug the History Press just because, yes, I still enjoy self-publishing certain books, but the History Press has such wonderful distribution into like actual brick and mortar bookstores, and they have a great online presence. So if you are yourself like a burgeoning historical author who'd like to break into the field, I think the History Press is great. Especially if you're a paranormal enthusiast, you know, if nobody's done a Haunted America title yet on your town or area, you know, that's, you know, potentially a way for you to get published. But I'm going to do a book with them next. You know, the contract is signed. The book is done. It probably won't come out till next spring. And we don't know the title yet, but it's going to be like Cryptids and Monsters of New Mexico.
Brilliant. Yeah. Sounds fantastic. And what about the ongoing cowboys and monsters and cowboys and aliens and all kinds of creepy things that people used to meet up with, John? Is that ongoing?
Yes, I'm about to conclude, though, the one that I call Cowboys and Saurians, because I've done 9 books in that series, and I have a good amount of stories left over for a 10th one, and I feel like 10's a nice number to end on, so I think next year in 2026, I'll put out the 10th book in that series, and that'll also be the 10th anniversary of my self-publishing company I have, Bicep Books, because I started that in 2016. So I think for the anniversary year, I'm going to try to publish at least 10 books through Bicep Books for the 10th anniversary. But we'll see if that actually happens.
Well, I wish
you the best. That's a pretty tall order.
Well, I wish you the best of luck wherever happens.
Yeah, thank you.
So where can everybody find your work, John, follow you online and get a hold of a copy of this book and some of the previous titles we've mentioned on this episode and in your previous appearances?
Oh, the easiest way is just to, you know, search my name on Amazon.com under books. But I'm also, I have a decent little Instagram page. I think it's just John LeMay Books, where I post pretty graphics and fun, you know, factoids from my different books, you know, probably every other day or something. So, but yeah, just search my name on Amazon. That's the easiest way to find me. And there's also bicepbooks.com. And that's about it, though.
Lovely. Well, I'll put links as usual
to
everything in the show notes, my friend. And I just want to say thank you again for joining me for a conversation. And thank you again for collating and collecting such a wonderful, wide-ranging collection of strange and spooky stories for us all to enjoy, John.
Oh, thank you, Paul. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.